Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
I'm joined by Raymond Arroyo. You know his voice, you know his face from EWTN. He is the host of The World Over. Watch that every Thursday night. And he's out with a new book. It is The Spider Who Saved Christmas, a legend. It is an illustrated book. It's for children and adults worldwide, I guess. But Raymond, jumping right into this, I'm Polish. I grew up in a Polish household. I'd heard this legend before, but I'd heard a secular version of it, and I'd never heard this particular version of it. So take us back to this legend, because it's been around for years, and I think in most parts of the world, all but forgotten.
Well, you know, Brian, thank you for having me on. But I totally agree. You know, when I traveled in Poland and Ukraine, during Christmas, I saw all the tinsel, and they have spider ornaments that they put in the trees. But I didn't quite make the connection or even ask, why do you have spiders in your trees? Turns out, I came across this two-line reference in a footnote of a big Bible commentary. And all it said is, there is a legend that on the flight to Egypt, the Holy Family encountered a spider who miraculously saved them. Now, that's all it said. So I was like, what's this story about? So I made a note. I came back to it later. Turned out there has been a legend, and it was in circulation for centuries. And then for whatever reason, it just disappeared. Now, there are, as you said, there's another legend about an old woman who was too poor to decorate her tree. The spider comes and decorates her tree. There is that legend. That's not this one. This is a spider who encounters the Holy Family. And when I look back at it now, a year and a half after I started this adventure, I call my spider Nephila. What Nephila teaches all of us is, if you have the eyes of faith, you can find hope even in the darkest of places. And that's what this story is about, and how each of us has a really important role to play, sometimes a pivotal role, and in a way we never anticipated, if we're engaged, if we worry about the other.
Well, of course, that is a theme throughout the book, that each of us we're all here for a reason, every one of us. What I thought was interesting, though, in the title is, and it was something I just noticed when I picked up the book, is you call it The Spider Who Saved Christmas. Now, spider's a noun, and you could have very well said The Spider That Saved Christmas. Why did you choose who? Why did you choose who versus that?
Well, you know, you're the only person who noticed that. Because originally it was The Spider That Saved Christmas. I like the idea of personifying her a little bit, and in English you can use it either way. You know, the usage can go either way, but I actually wrestled with that for a while. But I like the idea that she's a little, you know, she has her own personality, and she does. Though she doesn't talk like Charlotte, she's a golden orb weaver, which is a very rare breed of spider that is particular to the Middle East, Northern Africa. You can find it in some parts of South America. And they spin this very beautiful and sought-after golden silk. And I thought, if you're going to have a spider encounter the Christ child and the Holy Family, you may as well make it, you know, a really exquisite spider. So that was my little contribution. And I kind of added and embellished the edges of this story because it was such a spare legend, such a kind of a, you know, bold story, and almost too simple. So I gave it a little bit of a backstory. It allowed me an opportunity to focus on the relationship between Mary and Jesus and Joseph, and then bring this spider in. I did a lot of research on spiders. I learned a lot. So there are some scientific things that I've woven into the story, no pun intended. For instance, the way they communicate. You know, I have the spider plucking on her web to call her children out to help her in this task. And it turns out spiders have no ears. They cannot hear. They feel vibrations. And this is, according to the most recent research, it's how they communicate. They have little legs on the back of their abdomens, and they pluck on the webs and communicate that way to other spiders.
Well, of course, the name that you chose for the spider is a scientific background, right?
It does. Nephila is a part of the Latin term for this golden orb weaver, and she's slightly related to Charlotte, you know, which is Charlotte's Web, of course, a story we all love. Charlotte was a orb weaver, just a plain, you know, spider who spins web. Mine's a golden orb weaver because they have those golden silken webs, and you know, when I look at it now, when I watch children's reaction, and I've been amazed at the adults and kids who have reacted to it, and I love that families are reading it together this Christmas. they've all told me the impact, the unexpected impact of this, you know, spider that is an on-ramp into this story we thought we knew so well. But it has an old classic feel, but it's an entirely new story that you may not have heard before. Most people, I've discovered, even Poles like you and those from the Eastern Europe or of Eastern Europe derivation, didn't know the story, but they remember seeing their grandmother or their mother putting spider ornaments in the trees. So I hope it's a legend. I hope it's a practice we revive through this legend. And that's the other thing that drew me when I realized that this is why we hang tinsel in trees. It's an homage to this story. And it shows you the power of stories, how even the remnants of them stay with us long after the story themselves have been forgotten. And so I thought it was time to remind people of this great tale.
I'm chatting with Raymond Arroyo about his new book, The Spider Who Saved Christmas, a legend. It's available wherever the fine books are sold. Raymond, something that surprised me, and I was a little bit disappointed in myself that I was surprised by this, is Joseph in the book emerges as sort of the weaker, to me, the weaker of the two for a period in the book between him and Mary, because Joseph, very edgy, and Mary, very calm, and was almost keeping Joseph at an even keel. But as I thought back biblically, that's kind of how she was. She had to be the stronger of the two, right?
Well, I you see, that's interesting that was your takeaway. The letters I've been getting from everyone, including Anne Rice, posted a review of the book on Amazon, and she said she was struck, and so many of my readers are struck, by the assertiveness and the protector instinct that St. Joseph displays in the book. They saw just the opposite. They thought he was very strong and deliberate and take action. But you're right, there is that balance between the two of them where Mary is just more assured. But I love the complementarity of their relationship. We rarely see St. Joseph depicted in any... he's usually just a plant standing in the background with a staff and a lily, you know. You never get him in action. So it was important to me and to my illustrator, Randy Galagos, who did such a beautiful job cinematically recreating these moments in the story. But we wanted to make him very active and have him be the lead, if you will, in the early part of the story. And he is. But Joseph gives in to fear here. Early on, he naturally wants to protect his family from the spider, from the webs all around. That's a natural instinct. That's a good thing for a father and a protector to do. But Mary stays his hand, and early on in the story, she tells him, "Leave it, let it be. All are here for a reason." And that ends up not only being a commentary on this spider, who will, you know, have a remarkable part in their story, but it's also a commentary on her child, on the Christ child.
You know, you mentioned Randy Galagos, your illustrator, and as I look at the illustrations in the book, I may as well be standing in a museum looking at oil paintings, because that's exactly what they look like. That had to be a painstaking process to narrow down and find the proper illustrator for a book like this, right?
You know, Brian, I've never art directed a book before. I mean, I've my editor with illustrations and rejected and approved things. This was the first book I art directed, because we went through three illustrators and I was really unhappy with their work, and there was a vision we were really after. I wanted it to have a classic look, to make it, because, you know, in a picture book, 90% of the story is the pictures, then they get to your story. So it was really important to me that it had a classic old world feel. Randy not only captured the drama of the moment by moment of this story, but everything was done by hand. These are all hand-painted oils, and the colors are so rich, and the characters are so lively. And it was a heavy lift for him under a very tight deadline. But I have to tell you, I was thrilled with the final result and that we found him. And he couldn't have been better or easier to work with. In fact, we're doing another project together now.
And something else, you mentioned the moment of this story, and this takes place after Christ's birth, obviously, but it is while they're fleeing to Egypt, and I think that's also a forgotten tale of the nativity story, because this wasn't, you know, Christ was born, and then all of a sudden everything was great. This was a thriller. I mean, he was in fear of his, well, he wasn't, but his parents were in fear of his life.
Well, yeah, look, Brian, I always say, with the danger of the nativity story is that we consign this family to Fontanini figures under the tree, and, you know, we think we know that story. We understand it. In point of fact, we don't, because we rarely take the time to put ourselves in that moment. And you realize we may not all have angels singing outside our doors or, you know, kings coming over to visit our kid, but the thing we all have in common and share with this family in this moment is we're riddled with anxiety. We're concerned about our loved ones and their safety. We're hiding in our caves trying to protect them from the death that's just outside the door. You know, a year and a half after I started writing this, I realized there's a really powerful and important lesson for us in the midst of this COVID moment where we can't get into despair. Even though we're anxious, even though we're worried, there's a life to be lived, and there's hope to be had. And that stubborn faith, that stubborn hope, I think we need in this moment. And how, in many, many ways, grace and that hope comes through everyday things, even things that are feared like a spider. And that's at the heart of this story. That's the lesson that I've pulled from the story. You know, a year and a half, a story you write one way comes back and tells you something very different in time. And that's what I think good children's literature should do, and that's what this story has certainly done for me.
Not only do we see you on the world over on EWTN and interviewing newsmakers from all over the world, and some I know you had Dion on last week's episode, but we also see you on Fox News Channel with Laura Ingraham. You got a very funny segment you do on there. That's got to be a good diversion from the hard news stuff that you're doing to kind of take a look and laugh at things, right?
Well, you know what? It's my therapy. Yeah, I think we all have to take a breath, have a laugh. And, you know, when we started doing those segments at Fox, everyone said you can't do a culture segment in the middle of a show, and you don't want to be too light about it. You don't want to have too much fun. It turns out it's one of the highest rated segments in the prime time. And the reason is, I think, people want a break, they want to laugh and have a good time, and they want information. So we try to weave it together. Those segments are a lot harder to build than they appear to be. It looks like we're just kind of kicking back and having a good time. There's actually a lot of thought that goes into them and the pacing of them, and you know, you only have 5 minutes, 6 minutes tops. So it's a tight window, but I think it's important. It's important for people to laugh at themselves, to laugh at those around them, and to find joy in the world. Sometimes it's, you know, particularly in the world we find ourselves today, there's a lot of ugliness and unhappiness out there. We weren't made just to cry. And so that's kind of the conceit behind both the Seen and Unseen and the Friday Folly segments.
And you also have, when you do the world over, you're making news. Just a couple of weeks ago with the release of the McCarrick Report, you made some news that week by interviewing somebody who wasn't even interviewed for the McCarrick Report, yet took a lot of the brunt of it, right?
Yeah, Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano. Yeah, we had Vigano on the program, and he, you know, tried to defend himself, I think, against some of the charges made in that report. It was curious that he became, you know, a kind of a diplomat at a foreign post, sort of became the scapegoat for the whole affair, the McCarrick affair. Between that and the blame shifting to the dead, I thought it was all a very curious report, and not at all, to my mind anyway, particularly illuminating. There were victims left out of the report who were never interviewed, James Green and others. It was a very odd report, and again, I always think you have to look at the pedigree and the lineage of a bishop. Where did he come from? Who ordained him? Who were his mentors? That we really don't get in the McCarrick Report anywhere. And who his enablers really were. Aside from the fact that we learned that three bishops lied to John Paul II, who are all conveniently dead, no one else is really blamed here. And I know for a fact, I know personally, there are a lot of living, breathing bishops who were not only friends of McCarrick, but very close intimates of McCarrick, who are not named at all in that document. And the church has to do a better job of transparency. Just has to.
And I thought it was interesting the McCarrick Report was released on a Tuesday when, as a lover of books, I know that's when all great fiction is released, every Tuesday, right?
That's right. That's the pub day. Pub day is all. You always drop on a Tuesday. That's right.
All right. The book is The Spider Who Saved Christmas. It's a legend by Raymond Arroyo. The book is available now. It's a great Christmas gift and just a book that's going to be enjoyed by children of all ages. Raymond, just a fantastic offering. I loved it. I know my niece and nephews loved it as they read it, and I thank you for joining me to talk about it.
Thank you, Brian. My pleasure, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.